May it please the court, I'm Mike Ware, and I represent Thomas Jefferson Smallwood on direct appeal. I've got 15 minutes, as with my rebuttal brief, I plan on spending all or at least the majority of that 15 minutes on my first issue for review, the sufficiency of the legal insufficiency of the evidence of the aggravated counts.
You've got to know that I think there's only one standard, and that's the Jackson standard, which is both legal and factual. Whether any rational trier of fact could have found.
I agree 100%.
So
I think that's stated law.
So you don't need to limit it.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And the other points, the other issues for review are every bit as important. I think that for the most part they speak for themselves. If there's some time at the end of my 15 minutes, I may spend some time, or if the court has questions about those issues.
Well, limit yourself to the ones that were preserved, okay?
Okay. In my opinion, Your Honor, they were all preserved. But let me begin with the sufficiency of the evidence argument, which was definitely preserved because the trial counsel even based his entire motion for directed verdict on those particular counts and made the particular arguments or some of the arguments that I made on appeal. So that those points are definitely
preserved. Well, they don't have to be preserved in a criminal case, so.
That's correct, Your Honor. The appellant was convicted on 9 of 9 counts in a single charging instrument, a single indictment, 3 counts of sexual assault alleged to have occurred on October the 31st of 2012. And 6 counts of aggravated sexual assault alleged to have occurred, 2 on August the 10th, 2 on September the 10th, before the August 31st counts, and then 2 more on November the 6th, after the August 31st counts. The state failed to prove by sufficient evidence the alleged aggravating element of the 6 aggravated offenses, the 2 before the October and the 1 after the October. Now, I think it's worth noting that all 9 counts in the evidence at trial, the testimony at trial, allege purported offenses that occurred during the same criminal episode, as that is defined in the Penal Code 3.01, I believe. But the only relevance of that, and I'll get to that in a minute, why this is the only relevance, is that permits the state or the grand jury to charge every one of these separate freestanding offenses in the same indictment. Otherwise, each one of these freestanding offenses would have to be charged in a separate indictment, or at least if the defendant filed a motion to sever, would have to be so severed. So each count, each of these 9 counts is a standalone count, a standalone offense. On the indictment, the only thing that distinguished one from the other is the date. Otherwise, the wording is almost identical in every count. The state does not have to prove the exact date, but that's how the particular act is identified in this case. Each one is identified or associated with a particular date. And in each instance, the state has to prove every element, including the aggravating element, beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, there's 6 aggravated counts. They have to prove an aggravating element beyond a reasonable doubt 6 different times associated with each of the 6 different counts. They didn't even attempt to do that. The state failed in at least 2 respects. The purported threats that the state has cited in the brief, and I guess were cited in the arguments of counsel at trial, that were the aggravating element in each of these 6 counts. Some of them were not threats at all. They kept emphasizing how the defendant knew how to speak Spanish. There was some other things about he would talk about how he knew people in the Mexican mafia or knew hitmen in the Mexican mafia. The first time she talks, the complaining witness addresses threats is before any of this ever even purportedly occurred. I think it's June or July of 2012. The defendant, the appellate, and her mother are going through a nasty split up, and he, according to her, he says something about putting her mother in a hole or something like that, according to her testimony. And her testimony is, at that point, she's all on board with that. She's mad at her mother, and she's like, you know, she's like listening to that and kind of agreeing with it. They're both mad at her at that particular time, but it has nothing to do with any of the counts or any of the aggravating elements of any of the counts in the later alleged sexual assaults.
Okay, Mike, let me ask you this. If a person says, if you tell what we're doing, I will do something to hurt you, is the threat to hurt, if conditioned on the person telling, is that a threat if the person doesn't participate? Does it compel submission to the sexual assault by threatening to hurt the person if they tell? Is there a difference?
I think they overlap, but I think there is a difference, and I think every case depends on its facts. I think the Blunt case, which is still good law because it's still being quoted and cited up to 2013, probably after that, set the definition of what imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death means. In the Blunt case, it's a horrible case, as the perpetrators, I believe there were two of them, are leaving, they say, if you tell anybody about this, we'll come back and kill you, or something like that. And the Blunt court said that does not meet the term imminently as it was in the statute at that time, and rendered that case insufficient as a matter of law. Now, there have been several cases that have quoted that with approval, and I cite those in my brief. So none of these purported threats in this case, as enumerated by the state, none of these purported threats meet the Blunt test. And I would note that under the particular subsection of the statute under which the appellant was charged in each of these counts, under the particular subsection that enumerates the different ways a sexual assault can become aggravated, this particular subsection, as a matter of fact, this particular clause of this subsection is the only one that uses the term imminently. So it's there for a reason. It's been there since Blunt. So under the interpretation of imminently, imminent threat or threat of imminent death or serious bodily injury, none of these purported threats that were testified to meet that test.
Counsel, what about the testimony that at least on three of those occasions, did not the victim testify that on at least three of the occasions, the appellant specifically threatened her during the act of sexual assault?
You know, she really didn't. I mean, there's some leading questions in there. Let me give you an example. She testifies, well, after this was all over with, and of course, once again, we're not talking about same course of conduct or same criminal episode. There are some parts of this statute that allow a threat to be made that will aggravate the sexual assault if it's in the same criminal episode. There's a part just above the part that was alleged here that says, if this kind of threat's made in this sort of same criminal episode, then it aggravates it. There's one just below it that talks about if a deadly weapon is used or something during the same criminal episode. But this particular part of the statute number one, uses the term imminent bodily injury or death, and it does not use the term same criminal episode. So the threat, if it even fits the Blunt test, has to have been at the time that the sexual assault was committed. What she says, I believe, is that towards the end or after it was all over with, he told her this story, for example, according to her testimony, about, and it, you know, it's horrible testimony. I mean, she, he, told her a story of a girl that had been sexually assaulted by a babysitter, and later on she told, and the babysitter set her up on Facebook or something, and was the babysitter later murdered the person who was sexually assaulted. But this is after all these are over with. Arguably in the same criminal episode, but it's after all this is over with. And she says, and even she says that was not like a direct threat. Now, the prosecutor gets her back and says, well, it was during a sexual assault. And then they finally leave it, well, it was during the time period. Once again, the time period is from August to November. That's the criminal episode, but same criminal episode does not apply in this case because it wasn't indicted under a statute that speaks to same criminal episode. These threats, if they are threats and if they're the requisite threats that need to be made under Blunt and its progeny, have to be somehow connected to the specific counts, the specific three freestanding counts that have been alleged in this indictment. And the state never even made a pretense about connecting any particular threat to any particular count. They just happened during the time period. And under the law, clearly, that does not meet their burden of proof. Count one happened all on or about August the 10th, 2012. There is no specific threat, even if these threats are taken as sufficient, associated with count one or count two, both of which are alleged to have occurred August the 10th of 2012. The same with count three and count four, September of 2012. There is no specific threat that's ever testified to or any evidence that's associated with those two counts. And then we skip. We go to October. We know even the state acknowledges you can't backdate count. You can't backdate threats. You can't, you know, one threat doesn't apply at all, because then they skip October 31st. There's three counts in October where no threats alleged at all. Those are the non-aggravated counts. And then they go back to November and allege two aggravated counts where they allege a threat was made that fits the statute, but there's no testimony or evidence that associates any of these threats, if they meet the Blunt test, with any particular count. They're all just sort of amorphously grouped into this general time period, during this time period, during the same criminal episode. And as the statute points out, 22.021, if it can be aggravated, and this is right above the statute used in the, or the subsection used in the indictment, it can be aggravated if the perpetrator causes serious bodily injury or attempts to cause the death of the victim or another person in the course of the same criminal episode. So obviously the legislature is cognizant of that term, but that's not what applies here. What applies here is the next one: by acts or words places the victim in fear of death, serious bodily injury, or kidnapping will be imminently inflicted on any person. That's the only place in this whole statute where imminently is used. And then four, uses or exhibits a deadly weapon in the course of the same criminal episode. So I think to uphold this case as legally sufficient, the court's going to have to do two things. They're going to have to legislate from the bench. They're going to have to do two things. They're going to have to strike the word imminently from the statute that the appellant was indicted under, and they're going to have to engraft the words in the same criminal episode. Otherwise, the aggravating element fails in those two respects. It doesn't meet the Blunt test because it's not to be imminently inflicted as Blunt and its progeny require. And two, none of the purported threats, if they are sufficient, are associated or ever proven to be associated with any of the six indicted freestanding aggravated sexual assault allegations. which is not to say that that sort of evidence doesn't have some relevance. I mean, obviously, whoever assesses punishment in the case, in this case Judge Gallagher, can take that into account in the non-aggravated offenses, and probably he did, because he did give the appellate the maximum sentence, 20 years, in each of the non-aggravated offenses.
Okay, Deborah.
Yeah, y'all ready for me? May it please the court. I'm going to keep this pretty brief today because I really think this is a case where it depends. It's just very fact-specific. This is an odd case, factually. I would encourage the court to, if you haven't, watch the interview that he did, because I think you have to look at all of the evidence in this case to really understand what was going on. The sufficiency of the evidence, I mean, basically the cases say, and it makes sense, that a jury can consider the totality of the circumstances in determining whether an offense has been committed, specifically regarding threats. They can consider the defendant's express verbal threats. They can also consider the conduct that he engaged in. In this case, there were threats. We know explicitly there were threats that the defendant knew people in Mexico associated with the Mexican mafia. They would kill the victim and her mother without it being traced back to him. He told her a story about a man who raped his babysitter, and when she told, he tricked her using social media and then killed her, which is awful lot like this case. There's another threat where the lady she outcried to, she told that lady that he talked about slitting her throat, leaving her in a ditch somewhere. The victim in this case did testify that there were at least three occasions on which, during the sexual assault, he threatened her. And she testified that she was in imminent fear for her safety and her mother's safety. And I think the jury was certainly entitled to believe that. It's reasonable, considering these were threats made to a 15-year-old girl who was this defendant's stepdaughter while he was engaging in sexual activities with her, while she's wearing a bondage mask that covers her whole head, while he's videotaping what's happening and directing her activities. So, of course, in that circumstance, and this is also after she begins to sort of vocalize that she suspects he may be the one who is sort of setting all this up and behind the blackmail. So in those circumstances, it is reasonable. That's exactly how he intended these threats to come off to this 15-year-old victim, and certainly how she interpreted them. The testimony about her when she made the outcry, and then later on, she was truly in fear. So these are threats. They are specific. They're during the sexual assaults. Blunt is not controlling in this case because Blunt dealt with a different statutory language that talked about the threats compelling submission to the sexual assault. That language is, the compelling the submission is not in that statute anymore, and that makes a big difference. Now, Blunt is cited in some cases, but those are cases dealing with the defense of duress, and that defense also has the same compelling language in it.
But doesn't it also help define imminent?
Not necessarily. I think imminent can stand alone. I think compelling, when you read compelling and imminent together, certainly that lends you one reading. When you take compelling out, I think you come up with a different definition of imminent. And it makes sense, of course, these were imminent threats, because this is another way, in addition to the blackmail through social media, this is another way this defendant is exercising his control over this victim, and he is getting her to do what he wants her to do. This is another way to do that.
And unless, I was wondering, do you include the testimony about what J-Lo said to her, that he would invite all her friends to view the pictures of her on Facebook, a fake Facebook page that he had set up, and if she didn't do what he wanted her to do?
I do include them in the sense that they're relevant to examining the whole context of this, because that's certainly one thing the jury could consider in looking at is everything that had happened before, that he had had these kinds of threats and blackmail, and that it was only working so far. Now, I do not think you can look at those threats and say that they satisfy the sufficiency of the evidence standing alone, because they weren't threats of serious bodily injury or death. Unless this court has further questions, I will rely on my brief, and I thank you for your attention.
So essentially, this case is going to turn on a very close reading of the record.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it turns on a close reading of the record, and I really think this case turns on that this factually is such a odd, weird situation. It's going to be factually distinct than a lot of standard cases that you're going to see. And I think it also depends in good part on what weight are you, how much credibility determination can the jury make? Because when they listen to her talk about these threats, that the threats were imminent, that she was in fear, that they were specifically made in the sexual assault, do you defer to the jury in saying, yes, the jury could have found from that that the evidence is sufficient and they found that he committed these offenses? Or are we going to sort of second guess and say, well, we know the jury believes she was placed in fear, but we're going to say that shouldn't have been enough to do it?
Okay, I'm going to ask a hypothetical question. Suppose he had said, you know, I'm going to college and I'm going to learn how to make a bomb. And someday when you're not looking, I'm going to drop a bomb on your house and blow you up. Well, that's certainly a threat of violence during criminal episode or?
During the act, maybe.
But yeah, during the act. But is compelling totally out of the statute? Just any mention of violence?
Your Honor, I think compelling is totally out of the statute, because I think what we're trying to avoid is parsing and dicing of threats to see, well, did he threaten her? Is this because he wanted her to comply, or is he just trying to keep her quiet? I think what the legislature is getting at is when you threaten a victim with bodily harm while you're sexually assaulting them, you ought to be held accountable at a higher level. Now, I believe in your hypothetical that probably would not be an imminent threat, because it's specifically couched in terms of, you know, when I'm in college or some, you know, far date in the future. But here, these threats weren't couched that way, and it makes sense that given the background and the history between these two, that these were imminent threats, because this is what he needed to do to keep ensuring her compliance as long as he could.
What about if you tell? If you ever tell anybody, then I will come back and I will hurt you. Is that enough?
I think that one gets a lot. I think that's closer. I think it depends. In our case, this is an ongoing thing. She is with this guy. He sexually assaults her, I think, 12 to 18 times. I forgot exactly what her estimate is. The number of occasions were far greater than the convictions that we have here. But so this was an ongoing thing. So this wasn't a stranger who threatens, if you ever tell, I'm going to come back and do something to you at some indeterminate point in the future. But this is somebody she's living with who basically says, if you don't behave and do what I'm telling you to do, I'm going to have the assassins come after your mom or whatever. And to a 15-year-old in those circumstances, those are scary things.
What about, I'm going to post all your sexting on Facebook? That's not violence. That is certainly a threat, though. Where does that fall?
I think that is certainly a threat. Again, it's with Justice Gardner's example, I don't think that would meet the requirement if that was the only threat, because it's not a threat of serious bodily injury or death. But again, you can look and place the fact that he had those threats as well. When those threats are not working so well, we're going to kind of escalate and we're going to start to threaten violence.
What about, I'm going to post your sexual escapades on Facebook and the guy's wife is going to get really mad and she's going to come beat you up when she sees it on Facebook?
I think that one doesn't work either, because I think it has to be the person who's threatening the serious bodily injury or death.
Okay.
But again, I think you can certainly to say that that's not sufficient, but if there are additional threats in that kind of case, you could certainly consider that threat in determining the context of the other threats and in determining whether they were imminent and whether they were threats of serious bodily injury or death.
Thank
if there
you.
Are no more questions, I'll simply pray this case be affirmed. Thank you.
Mike?
You know, to this point, I think in all fairness, I still don't understand what the state's position is on what the nexus has to be between the threat and the act itself. The state has mentioned three threats in their brief, so taking them at face value, that he knew people in Mexico associated with the Mexican mafia and they would kill her and her mother without being traced back to him. I'm not sure that's an accurate, exact quote. That's characterizing some of what she did testify to, but which count is that associated with? Is that associated with the August count that was tried, two counts that were tried, or the September? We know it's not associated with the October count, three counts, because there's no allegation that it was a threat was made during that encounter. There's no nexus between the purported threats, either as she testified to them or as the state has characterized them or recharacterized them, and any of the alleged specific counts. A story about a man who raped his babysitter when she told he killed her. She says this is after all this. She says that was not like a direct threat. And once again, certainly, if the sentencer believes that testimony, that's something they can take into consideration in sentencing, but it's not something that aggravates what is otherwise a second-degree 3G offense to a first-degree 3G offense that changes the characteristics of the offense. And once again, there's no count that threat can be nexused with. Obviously, she says it's after all of it. If they can't backdate it to all the counts, because then they have to jump over October. Because October, there's no threats associated with those three counts. And then that he would slit her throat and leave her in a ditch somewhere. Once again, the complaining witness never said anything like that, never testified to that. The outcry witness said that she told her that. And, of course, the outcry, by definition, is going to be after all of this. And once again, there was no effort at all made to associate that purported threat that the complaining witness never testified to any of the six alleged aggravating counts. So I still don't know what nexus there has to be in the state's position, what nexus there has to be between the threat and the act itself. I mean, can the threat be made a year later and then backdated to the actual sexual assaults to make them aggravated? The only reasonable interpretation when it gets down to it is the threat has to be of the requisite kind as defined by Blunt and its progeny, and it has to have been proven to be part of the actual alleged offense, the actual sexual assault. Not made sometime during the same criminal episode, because that's addressed elsewhere in the statute, but at the time of the actual sexual assault, or to use the state's term, at the time of the actual encounter.
Well, but isn't there testimony by the victim that three times during the actual sexual assault he threatened her?
I think the state finally does get her to say something like that through leading questions, but then it's changed to the same time during in that same passage. And as this court has acknowledged, this is very record intensive. During that same passage says, during the same time period. It morphs from during the sexual assaults to during the same time period in that same passage.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your argument.